Welcome to Season 3 of Busting Addiction and Its Myths, sponsored by Safe House Rehab Thailand, where we offer a modern approach to recovery, breaking with tradition by introducing new technologies that help disrupt the cycle of addiction. To learn more, visit us at safehouserehab.com and click on the video, or contact us at info@safehouserehab.com, and we'll tell you about our $1,000 airfare allowance and referral rewards program. My name is Bruno J., and here's why I created this podcast. Our research has shown that despite the opioid epidemic and the worldwide panic over the ravages of addiction, we didn't see that treatment centers were doing anything different to break the cycle more effectively and improve the odds of long-term success. So we have set out to do things differently and to let all those who love an addict or alcoholic know more about the advances in treatment that we represent. Here's what we're doing differently. We have designed our diagnostics and detox to isolate and treat opioid and multi-addiction, example, alcohol plus opioids plus speed, more effectively, given that these are the new challenges of addiction in the 21st century. We integrate leading-edge technology into the recovering process, thereby disrupting the disorder, speeding the recovery of brain health. Clients come to treatment with damaged brains. This is a given. We pay attention to the importance of dopamine and other ingredients vital to brain health recovery. Traditional rehabs don't provide anywhere near the tools and close guidance that clients truly need to help keep them clean and sober for life. We do it right. First, we advise our clients to go into a sober living facility to serve as a transition to normal life, and we absolutely outperform traditional rehabs when it comes to providing a structure for long-term recovery. So if you love an addict or alcoholic, and you feel like your loved one is sucking the oxygen out of your life, is stealing your money, stealing your peace of mind and your sanity, this podcast is for you. If you're feeling rage and shame and he or she is living rent-free in your head 24/7, this podcast is for you. I hope to have you gain a better understanding of the nature of addictive disorder and the invisible effect it has on your psyche. It's my fervent hope you also gain a little more compassion for your loved one and for yourself, in spite of this cunning, baffling, and powerful disease. To paraphrase an author in this space, we struggle because we love. Hi, Bruno J. This is episode 5 of season 3 with Andrew. Hi, Bruno J. We're going to interview today a young fellow by the name of Andrew, who is clean and sober a number of years. He'll tell you a little bit about his story. And Andrew, if you could start with what you're doing today, how many years you have sober, and then we'll go back to what it was like, what happened, the role of your parents, and then what is life like today. So why don't you get us started?
All right, sounds good. Hey, everybody. I'm Andrew. I've been sober since February 7th of 2015, so a little over 5 years. Where I'm at today, my life is pretty good. I have a solid employment as an aquatic director at a fitness facility, you know, managing the aquatics department, running some lessons and so on and so forth. And my life's pretty good today. Things are pretty stable. You know, happy, joyous, and free. So that's me. That's where I'm at today.
So what are you doing with respect to work and so forth?
So as I mentioned, I'm an aquatic director running a swimming pool at a YMCA. And I've been working in pools for a long time. Even as a teenager, I was able to hold a job as a lifeguard. And since then, has, you know, just increased my education and my certifications, and got myself in a position where I was able to head a whole department, which has been good. It's been good to me so far.
So go back to how you got yourself started on the road to your wake-up call and recovery.
Okay, so I guess, you know, getting started on the road, you know, I had some experiences. Well, first off, I mean, you know, I was kind of stuck in life. You know, I really hadn't gone anywhere. I dropped out of university. I was working the same part-time job. I never got my driver's license or anything. I mean, I was kind of stuck. I was renting a house from my mom for next to nothing. You know, really just at a standstill in life. And I started asking myself why, at a certain point. And, you know, I was really crippled by fear. There's a lot of things. I mean, I was afraid to even apply for better jobs. So I started to ask myself the questions as to, you know, why can't I move forward? Why am I still stuck here? You know, one glaring thing kept popping up that, you know, maybe I have a problem with alcohol, which was a seed that was planted in my mind, you know, several years before I actually started to believe it. And eventually, you know, out of numerous attempts to try to stop on my own, you know, to where I realized, that I don't think I have the capability to stop on my own. I was also using other drugs as well. You know, mostly marijuana and psychedelics and things like that. You know, and every time I tried to stop on my own, I realized I couldn't stay stopped. And that eventually, when I was finally able to get all the substances out, you know, and I was left with all the, you know, all the emotions, thoughts, and feelings that I had been pushing away for years, you know, I realized I wasn't going to be able to stay sober without getting help. So that's when I, you know, I reached out on Facebook like a good young person. And I just vented all my problems right there for the public, right? And
how old were you at the time?
I was 24.
Okay.
I was almost 25. I was 24. It was a couple months before my 25th birthday, and I vented out, you know, and a woman that I had worked with, who was a little bit older than, well, quite a bit older than me, about twice my age, had reached out to me, and, you know, unbeknown to me, she had been a member of a 12-step group for quite some time, and she invited to take me to a meeting. She drove across the city and picked me up, and I didn't decide until, you know, she had offered it to me, and I took a few days to think about it, and it was a Sunday morning meeting at 8 a.m., and, you know, I still am not the greatest morning person, but I decided 6 a.m. on Sunday that I would go, and I sent her a message and said, okay, I'll go. And she, you know, with 2 hours, picks me up on the other side of town, takes me to the meeting on her side of town, and then drives me back home. And she did that for me for a couple months before. She said, okay, now you got to get yourself here, you know. But that was my start to recovery, you know. That was my most genuine start, because there were a few times in the past before that where I had some exposure to AA or a 12-step group, you know, and then there was another time where I had you know, some hospitalization as a result of excessive drug use, and neither of those times really did it for me, but they did plant that seed. So, you know, but when I honestly came to recovery, it was when I was 24, and it was really ultimately thanks to this person who reached out to me, because I don't know if I would have walked through the doors of a 12-step meeting, you know, without somebody reaching out that hand.
So tell me, Andrew, give me an example of a typical day before before you accepted help. Like, go back a year before you bottomed out, so to speak. What was a typical day like for you?
A typical day? I'd normally wake up early afternoon. I mean, it depends. I mean, there were different points where I was throughout my addiction where it had been worse and better. But, you know, when I was still drinking, you know, typically I would sleep until, you know, the earliest I'd ever get up was like 10 or 11 in the morning, you know, but normally it was like 12 or 1 or sometimes even later. You know, I worked part-time, and mostly in the evenings. I mean, there were various other part-time jobs that I had throughout that time. And what I would do is I'd wake up and I would smoke some marijuana first thing every day, you know, without fail. That was always the first thing I would do. And then who knows what I'd get into, you know, for the next few hours, probably end up smoking some more marijuana. And then I would go to work for, you know, 4 hours in the evening, 4 or 5 hours.
So
you know,
when you
start work at 3:30 or 5,
When you were working, were you you were you must have been stoned while you were working.
Oh, I was. Yeah, I was almost ice stoned. Almost guaranteed. I was stoned every day, all throughout the day. You know, I was never completely, I guess, you know, completely blitzed, but I would maintain a certain buzz, you know, throughout the whole day. And then by the end of the day, you know, when I was leaving work, I would start drinking right after work, you know, right when I get home, or I'd go to the bar, you know, if it was when I was already of age. Surprisingly, for an alcoholic, I never tried to go to a bar underage. I guess I wanted to save that as something special, but didn't stop me from drinking, right? You know, I just didn't drink at the bar. You know, I had some friends who would get in and be like, oh, you can get into this place. I said, yeah, I want to have something when I turn 21. I mean, I've already been doing this stuff for years, you know. kind of a silly thing, but then I would drink all night, you know, until 2-3 in the morning or whenever the booze would run out, typically, or I'd pass out, you know, whichever came first. There was normally not me making a decision to stop, you know. And then sometimes, you know, I would end up doing other drugs, you know, whether it was, you know, some cocaine or some psychedelics, some LSD or psilocybin mushrooms or something like that, or ecstasy. You know, it kind of just, I was a pretty opportunistic person. So,
okay.
You know, if something showed up, I would typically be open to it, you know.
The only thing I didn't hear you said you tried or used was either heroin or fentanyl. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, I've never used heroin. I've never used fentanyl. I've never smoked crack.
But almost everything else. Almost everything else.
Almost everything else. Pretty much everything else. Yeah. I mean, I've tried, you know, opiates, prescription opiates, which I wasn't a big fan of the downers for some odd reason. You know, they just made me feel sick, and I didn't want to feel sick.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to be zonked out of my mind. I wanted to be somewhere else, you know.
Okay. Tell me about the relationship you had with your mom before you woke up and after you woke up, because this is really important. Our audience is really meant for the loved ones of alcoholics and addicts, and how to go about healing that relationship going forward, or at least having a healthy relationship with a loved one who's an addict, and doing sort of the right Al-Anonic sorts of things. So can you cover that territory for us, please?
I'm the youngest of three kids, and then, you know, I have an older stepbrother as well who's older than all of us, and she also raised him for a while after my dad left, and before my dad left, she raised him for a while. So my mom was pretty exhausted. You know, we all gave her a run for her money, and then turns out her youngest was the one with addiction problems, right? So she was pretty wiped out by the time I started getting into my addictions. Before that, I was generally a pretty good kid. She tried her best, I think, to try to help me, but I was so stubborn and hard-headed, rebellious, and thought that I was, you know, not messing up my life. You know, I really thought I was doing fine.
Yeah.
And she knew I wasn't, but I wouldn't, you know, she would try to discipline me, and I would just not give her the chance, you know. I mean, she would try to ground me, and what would I do? I would storm out, you know. And it got to the point at one point in time in my later teenage years where she was actually afraid of me, physically afraid of me. And I, you know, I would get real loud arguments with her, you know, yell at her a lot. There was one time that she smacked me. You know, and I had this knee-jerk reaction. I smacked her back. It's one of my biggest regrets, you know, honestly. And, you know, instantly I was, you know, shit, what did I just do? Excuse my language, sorry. I was like, oh, no, you know, what did I just do? You know, I just hit my mom. And, you know, it was an unconscious thing. she realized that there was really nothing she could do to stop me or to discipline me. But she was such a compassionate person, and to the point of being an enabler, right, that she continued to make sure I had a roof over my head.
Yeah.
She continued to make sure I had everything I need, you know, making sure I was fed and making sure that, you know, whatever. And I took it all for granted, you know, because I just wanted to get drunk and I didn't want to deal with her. I wanted to party with my friends.
So it sounds
pretty bad. I had to deal from her, all that.
Sounds like your mom had her own turning point, almost her own sort of wake up call that, as you mentioned, the realization that there was nothing really that she could do to get you to stop, but she could still love you and take care of you while all that was happening. You mentioned enabling. Looking back now, it sounds like there was a substantial amount of it, but were there times when she came to realize that she wasn't really helping you? After you, quote, got clean and sober, what, now almost 6 years ago, is that right?
About five years ago,
okay.
Months or so.
A little bit more than 5 years ago. How did your relationship with your mother change at that point?
Life, and she had a pretty good life, especially after I got sober. I mean, she didn't have that much to worry about anymore. But, you know, I think she just kept holding on to that stuff. And you know, I mean, because it's traumatic, and I have to remember that, you know, what I put my mother through, a therapist might call trauma, you know?
Yeah. Were there any trust issues moving forward after you sobered up?
Yeah, I mean, there were some, but she saw how much progress I was making, and she definitely opened up, you know. I mean, I remember the day I got keys to my mom's house, my mom and stepdad's house, and that was maybe more surprising because my stepdad was open to it, but I mean, mind you, my 21st birthday was on Easter, and I was at their house, and I got completely hammered by, you know, 3 in the afternoon, and I was passed out at home by 5 p.m., and I made a complete fool of myself in front of my whole stepdad family, my family. You know, it was one of the last Easters that my grandpa was coherent, and I just completely, you know, got annihilated, and I had lost trust with my stepdad, especially at that point. I mean, he said, hey, Andrew can't drink at my house anymore ever again. You know, and I had just turned 21, you know. So I just remember the day that I got keys to their house was like mind blowing. That one, he would allow me those, and two, that my mom actually trusted me. I mean, you know, my mom was such a big hearted person that I think she always knew deep down inside that I loved her and that I didn't mean to cause harm. You know, and I didn't. I mean, I don't think I ever really meant to cause harm. I was just a sick person. And I think to some level she knew that. Whether she was, would say it or not, I think she understood that part. So when I sobered up and she saw me doing good, you know, over the span of a few months and then, you know, ultimately a few years before she passed, you know, we definitely regained trust. She trusted me. Completely. I mean, she didn't necessarily trust me to cut the grass on exactly the day that she wanted me to cut it, but she knew it would get done, you know? Versus before, where it wouldn't get done, you know. But in general, yeah, she would trust me, you know. She would trust me a lot. And,
right.
You know, the last couple of years, she was, you know, she was sick with cancer, pancreatic cancer, and, you know, she would call me and give her rides. She would, you know, whatever it was, take her to the hospital, and she knew she could trust me to do those things. And I was happy to do them. You know, I wish I had more time, you know, to do more things with her.
Right. Well,
you know.
So Andrew, what do you do today to stay clean and sober and grow as a human being?
Today, I still participate in 12-step groups. I sometimes talk to my sponsor, not probably as often as I should. But another thing that I've really gotten into is I practice with the Buddhist community. That's an international Buddhist community, and I've gotten really involved in that community. And I do a lot of I try to do what we would call the 12-step programs, service work, you know, in that community. I help organize local events. I help facilitate things with our local group in the city I live in. And I use a lot. I use the methods, you know, the meditations. You know, I follow the suggestions of my teacher, the teacher of the organization, and you know, and that's been really helpful for me, especially in the last few years. You know, working with meditations, different meditations, and trying to maintain a certain view about life. You know, seeing everybody as having this, what we call Buddha nature. You know, seeing everybody as having really great qualities. You know, and trying to hold that view. And trying to act like a Buddha till I become one, as we say in that group.
I hear you. What about the 12 steps specifically, how they have helped you, if so, change internally?
So, you know, what happens, and, you know, my sponsor has said this, and maybe you've heard this before, you know, is that you do your work on the steps, and then you let the steps do their work on you.
Right.
So it's kind of like a cup of tea, right? You know, you put the tea bag in. If you pull it out right away, you're just going to have hot water. If you leave it in too long, especially, you know, say like with green tea, you leave it in too long, it gets bitter, you know. But what happens is that something changes, right? You go from this clear water now to this, you know, green water that's flavorful. So what I found is that through working the steps, the 12 steps, you know, it's changed something inside of me, just like blue water and tea, right? Where it's now instilled some working parts of my life. You know, these principles that become working parts of my life. So principles that come from
there. You go.
The honesty. You know, just taking responsibility for my actions. You know, being able to notice when I've done wrong or caused harm, and then take responsibility for that and face up to it. You know, if I hurt somebody, go up to that person and apologize, you know. And those are simple things that, you know, I couldn't do before.
Right.
You know, being honest was not always easy. Or I thought I was being honest, but I was lying by omission, you know, right. Or something like this. You know, it's just, there's a lot of things I have an interesting view about these things today because lately I've pretty heavily influenced from my Buddhist practice, you know, that I've developed these habits, you know, as an alcoholic, I developed all of these different habits, and maybe even this was happening before alcoholism, right, where, you know, I had these instincts, just like everybody else, you know, instincts to be financially secure, emotionally secure, you know, sexually secure, whatever it was, I have these natural human instincts. But I eventually developed these habits that were based from those instincts, but to an extreme, you know, to try to fill those holes.
Okay. We're running up against our clock now, but I want to ask you, what advice would you give a parent or a loved one of an alcoholic or addict who is still using? What sort of mindset should they adopt?
I can take care of me.
Right.
And I think that's my biggest advice is for people to, like, you know, as much as we love somebody, we have to take care of ourselves when we're dealing with people
Perfect.
With addiction, you know,
Perfect.
Because it can be taxing to try to fix somebody. It can be taxing, you know, and it can sacrifice our own sanity. So,
yep. Perfect.
I think this is really important.
Well, we're going to have to leave it here, Andrew. I will call you back later to wrap up, and can't thank you enough for your time, and thanks for staying up. Thanks for staying up, Andrew.
Yeah.
Take care.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Right, take care. Bye.
So what did we learn from Andrew today? As he mentioned, it's rare that an addict or alcoholic becomes addicted to only one substance these days. It's called polyaddiction, and that's the norm. Andrew pretty much said that he tried everything. He used everything except for heroin, fentanyl, and smoking crack. So he says he did everything else, pretty much. Number two, mother is the great enabler. She tries to help him stop while at the same time allows him to live virtually rent-free in her second home. So love overcomes common sense, if you will. And she's the great enabler. She loves her son, but at the same time, she is doing everything she can to get him to stop. Three, Andrew hated the way he felt and wanted to stop, but he didn't know how. He came to realize that he could not quit on his own and needed to reach out and beg for help. And finally, number five, connecting to other young recovering people got him into his first 12-step meeting, where he surrendered his old ways of thinking, and he's been clean and sober ever since. Thank you for tuning in today. It's my fervent hope we've given you new insight and new hope that will lighten your burden. For our hearts go out to all who suffer the effects of addictive disorder. Please give us your feedback at info@safehouserehab.com. By all means, ask us any question you like, and we'll answer on air if you will. And if you want to leave us your first name and city, we'll recognize you too, of course. This podcast is sponsored by safehouserehab.com, where we take a modern approach to recovery, something all families of those who suffer deserve. Tune in next week for more.